The day of travel turned into 4 full days on a small plane with Hutchison and her husband, Ray. It was great fun, and at the end of the tour, I was offered a paid position on the campaign. But at the same time, I was offered a job working on the lawsuit reform effort. In part, since I had just finished a campaign, I was not sure jumping into another competitive race was something I was ready to do, so I accepted the lawsuit reform position. I would not have gotten the job had Rove not suggested my name. Rove was becoming the dominant force in Texas politics. He was viewed by many political observers in the state as a fierce competitor who at times could be ruthless and vicious, operating with a take-no-prisoners mentality. I stayed in contact with Carl sporadically over the next few years. In 1994, his company did some work for my mother's election to the Railroad Commission, which regulated the Texas oil and gas industry, the first statewide campaign I managed. But that year, he was mainly focused on Bush's gubernatorial campaign. Texas had already been trending Republican, and Rove engineered a Republican sweep of all statewide executive offices in 1998. I remember election night well. My mother had been in one of the more closely contested races, and many pundits rated her chances against the incumbent as poor. But we pulled off the upset and helped ensure the Republican sweep. All the Republican candidates were holding their individual victory parties at the same hotel in downtown Austin, the Capitol Marriott. Our room was a few steps from the main ballroom where the Bush campaign was celebrating. Later in the evening, as it was starting to become apparent that my mother would also win, Rove appeared at her party. I was sitting in a cordoned off area just to the right of the door where we had tables and computers set up to monitor the votes as they came in. In a loud and energized voice, Rove said, "I want to congratulate the person responsible for this victory. And there he is," he added as he turned to the right and pointed to me. "She could not have won without you, buddy. You did a fabulous job." This was heady praise for a 26-year-old. Here was the top Republican political strategist in the state and the new kingmaker of Texas politics, going out of his way to offer words of validation. We shook hands and embraced. "I don't know that it was me, but thanks," I said. "Your words mean a lot, and I appreciate them very much." Rove was the go-to guy in Texas for young politicos such as myself. If you wanted to get a political job in Republican politics, Rove was at the top of the list of people to visit. And despite his busy schedule, he was always generous with advice and help. Many younger operatives in Texas considered themselves dedicated followers of Rove and his school of politics. I never really felt that way. I always viewed myself as a more independent political operative, one who was not necessarily tied to any one strategist or camp within the Texas Republican Party. But I knew that Rove was the kingmaker in Texas Republican politics, and I appreciated and welcomed his support. After I joined Bush's team in 1999, I would see Carl occasionally at a senior staff meeting in the governor's office. By the time I moved over to the campaign, months later, I would see him frequently in the hallways of our campaign headquarters in downtown Austin, especially after I became traveling press secretary. When not on the road, I would attend the daily message meeting of senior aides, which Carl also attended, and frequently he would join us on the campaign trail. I came to know Carl even better when I joined him on the senior White House staff. I will always recall fondly how Carl inserted his brand of levity into the demanding, draining life inside the White House bubble. He has an endearing, goofy side that he used to boost morale, especially during the rigors of an election campaign, when every day in another hotel felt like yet another Groundhog Day. Toward the end of the 2004 election campaign, for instance, Carl used to rev up his fellow Bush team passengers and the staff fans by loudly leading us in some of the famous chants from the Republican convention in New York that August. He would just start yelling, "USA, USA, 4 more years, 4 more years, or one of our favorites, "Flip, flop, flip, flop." You may remember the large flip-flop beach sandals that conventioners waved to symbolize John Kerry's tendency to change his position on issues. I would usually follow right along, and others would join in at times. I think sometimes our volunteer driver, usually a local supporter, would wonder whether Carl had been on the road too long or needed to get out of the sun. I'm sure many an onlooker must have wondered, "Is this the famous political genius?" In the 2000 campaign, I remember hanging out late on election night in Carl's campaign office. Several other aides were in his office or nearby. Carl was working the phones, checking emails, and crunching numbers from the Florida counties. He had been energized by the way the networks had earlier called Florida for Gore, only to reverse themselves. Carl had been going around headquarters saying that conservative precincts in the Florida panhandle were still voting and that the closeness elsewhere made the network projections premature. Now, after their reversal, Carl seemed emboldened and determined, almost as if his sheer willpower was magically turning things in our direction. Shortly after 1 a.m., Fox News became the first network to project a Bush win in Florida, and with it, a victory in the national election. This was a thrilling development, but like others, I stayed silent, not sure whether to believe it and watching to see whether Carl and his usually spot-on number crunching agreed. But a few nail-biting minutes later, the other networks followed suit, reversing their earlier projections. The euphoria could not be contained. The other staffers and I let out enthusiastic yells, raised our arms, and high-fived one another. Rove led staffers who had remained behind at campaign headquarters to follow results in a march down Congress Avenue in Austin to the front of the state capitol. Bush was supposed to appear there, but later results caused the networks to reverse course again and say it was too close to call, and Gore withdrew his congratulatory call. Carl is without a doubt one of the brightest political talents of our time, thanks to his boundless energy and enthusiasm, his deep historical knowledge, and his keen insights into the electorate. He is a sharp strategic thinker and a savvy, shrewd, and devious strategist. Carl lives, eats, and breathes politics, and he loves everything that comes with it, particularly the competition and verbal combat. To him, politics is a contact sport, and he relishes the partisan warfare. Carl also has a reputation as a ruthless, perhaps unscrupulous operator, and has always struck me as the kind of person who would be willing, in the heat of battle, to push the envelope to the limit of what is permissible ethically or legally. Rove likes to have his hands in just about everything, relishing policy shaping as much as political strategizing. He views governing and politics as completely interconnected, and he occupied a key seat at the center of both in Bush's White House. Named senior advisor to the president just weeks before the inauguration, Rove was charged with overseeing politics and political strategy, and he headed four key offices aimed at one overarching objective: shaping and manipulating sources of public opinion, much as in a political campaign, to help advance the Bush agenda and policies. Each office was influential in its own right, and combined under Rove, they formed a massive, powerful operation that would drive a campaign-like effort to strengthen the president's standing with the public, as measured by his all-important approval ratings. And they often did so very effectively. The Office of Strategic Initiatives served primarily as a long-range strategic planning outfit. This office hadn't existed in previous administrations. My sense is that it built on and consolidated into one operation a number of equivalent functions carried out by previous White House staffs. But in its current form, it was Rove's grand creation. This office looked weeks and months down the road, planning the president's public focus in terms of his policies and agenda. But it also stayed integrally involved in day-to-day White House operations, sending a staffer to attend most key meetings. It also routinely engaged in research, monitored polling data, coordinated key strategy meetings, and daily played an integral role in helping the president set his agenda. The Office of Political Affairs coordinated a broad range of politically oriented events and activities, keeping in close contact with the Republican National Committee and with Republican leaders and activists in states and communities around the nation. It was also responsible for preparing detailed political briefing papers for Bush's trips to various states and localities, including an overview of each state's political climate, demographic characteristics, noteworthy issues, recent election results, media markets, congressional delegations, state leaders, and GOP party leaders, and a summary of previous visits to the state by Bush and his cabinet members. In effect, it prepared an information kit that provided the president an instant overview of the political context for anything he would say or do during a visit, making it easier for him to couch his message appropriately for a particular setting. The Office of Public Liaison worked closely with key constituencies and public interest groups, from trade associations like the Chamber of Commerce, to groups like National Right to Life, to African-American leaders and organizations. Staffers were assigned various constituencies, business groups, social conservative organizations, Hispanic outreach, and many others. Public Liaison helped mobilize such constituencies as needed to advance important priorities and manage their meetings with the president. Sometimes its job was to neutralize a group, attempting to dissuade an influential organization from openly opposing an initiative that might cause consternation for its members. An example might be keeping a group that represents the elderly from openly opposing personal or private retirement accounts for younger workers during the Social Security debate of 2005, using the argument that future reforms would not impact any currently retired people.